From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright and Wisconsin native Ayad Akhtar explains the inspiration for his latest play, Junk.
What I wanted to do was tell the story of how we became a nation that was beholden only to economic value. We have eradicated almost every other metric for our collective well-being other than dollars. And it doesn't matter whether you're on the right or you're on the left. I mean, now that's how it operates.
Then Radio Chipstone examines a new exhibit by Jillian Lau that originated from prom night photography into an exploration of segregation.
It needs to be okay to not agree with each other. This may make a lot of people uncomfortable, but you can't shut your eyes and just close down on things that make you uncomfortable.
Plus, we'll have the latest in our storytelling series, X Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next, after the news.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. You'd be forgiven for thinking playwright and Brookfield native Ayad Akhtar is moonlighting as an economist. From The Invisible Hand, which touches on terrorism and futures markets, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning Disgraced, whose lead character works as a high-powered mergers and acquisitions broker, economics is something that has always fascinated the playwright.
His latest work is called Junk, and it's been running at the Milwaukee Rep for a couple of weeks now, after a run on Broadway and in Europe. The play is set in the junk bond era of the 1980s, which is familiar if you lived through it, or if you've seen the Michael Douglas film Wall Street. At its heart is the counterintuitive idea that debt is something of value. Akhtar joined us in the studio while the play was still in rehearsal, and he explained then that he sees the play as a ritual enactment of an origin myth.
That's what the theater at its core is. It's ritual. It's the reenaction of mythic narrative. I mean, that's Greek tragedy, and in many ways, that's some of what Shakespeare's doing at his best. And I think that what I wanted to do was tell the story of how we became a nation that was beholden only to economic value. You know, we have eradicated almost every other metric for our collective well-being other than dollars. And it doesn't matter whether you're on the right or you're on the left. I mean, now that's how it operates. So how did that become our language? How did that become our privileged perspective on reality? Telling that story, I think, you know, meant starting it in the 80s, because that's really when I think that the sort of critical – we got to a sort of critical point, critical mass was reached.
What do you think were the things that led to that in the 80s? Why were we there? Why was the time ripe?
Well, you know, the history is complicated and long, and I think some of it has to do with the sort of post-war boom time, which the economic foundations for that had to do with our support of the world economy through Bretton Woods, whereby we guaranteed the price of gold for $35 an ounce, and we did that for about 30 years. And that what that meant was that the United States was and the U.S. dollar were at the center of the world's economy. But the sort of systemic pressures to sort of keep gold at $35 an ounce in the early 70s meant that we couldn't do it anymore. Nixon took us off the gold standard, the Bretton Woods system. And then what happened was a sort of cascading series of economic problems and economic crises, and a sort of those were dovetailing and meeting with sort of social and morale crises. You know, we had the Vietnam War, we had JFK's assassination, we had the sort of betrayal of our symbolic king, Richard Nixon, and a disillusionment with politics. And I think in the wake of all of that, the rise of the Goldwater set and republicanism under Reagan really meant that individualism and the sort of unfettered expression of individualism in the private sector became a way to resolve some of these more fundamental social contradictions. But what that meant was that under Reagan, the sort of extensive deregulation, and I think the most important part of that deregulatory process is one that is very seldom discussed, which is the antitrust regulation. You know, but what happened was that this sort of Reagan ideology, or sort of the Bork, really was really the Bork ideology, meant that you know, the only thing that we should be thinking about when we're thinking about antitrust is we should be thinking about what's good for the consumer. is it going to lower prices? And so that laid the foundation for a kind of scale, a march to scale, where, you know, now Walmart controls 50% of grocery store sales in so many metro markets, you know, and Amazon is basically putting, you know, brick and mortar retail out of business, but the Justice Department is going after the publishers for collusion. It's a world in which we don't recognize anymore any other value other than the economic one, and in this case, the compact or the covenant with the citizen is really lowest price. We're not going to take care of your rights to protection. We're not going to offer you education. We're not going to offer you health care. We're not going to offer you any of those things that were considered the rights of citizenship, right? What we're going to offer you is the lowest price. And that's the justification that becomes a kind of wholesale ideological push across every industry sector, and which has basically gutted the center of the country. It has redirected wealth to individual spots along the coast, and it has laid the foundation for a kind of, you know, slide into disrepair and despair that has resulted politically in the situation that we're in. You know, we live in a world where individualism, whether it's the right to make as much money as you want or to use whatever bathroom you want, are really the reigning ideological fights. We have ceased to ask the question of what is our collective well-being and what is a collective. So in that landscape, the play, because we've drifted somewhat afield from that.
But not very far.
Not really.
No.
Not really. The play tries to depict two styles of doing business. And, you know, I am not a bleeding heart liberal or a, you know, closet Marxist or what have you, but I am somebody who recognizes the sort of historical consequences of our choices. And the play stages a battle between two visions of capitalism. One is a more paternalistic, entrenched, ethnically homogenous, older version of capitalism that is sensitive, more sensitive to its effects on locality. And then you have a new younger generation of capitalists who are diverse and multicultural and who are espousing a kind of meritocratic vision of society and who really don't care about locality. And I think that that's the battle that has really played itself out sort of against the canvas of the American experience.
What's so interesting is that the people who are multicultural and embrace that sort of thing are usually the people who are depicted as the ones who care more. and that did you see the air quotes there?
Yeah.
They're the ones that are supposed to be more sensitive.
Sure.
And you have them not.
Well, sensitivity is a liability in our nation. You know, the only expression of will par excellence in American life is the accumulation of wealth. So that's just a fact. And if you want to do something, you want to put the NRA out of business, you make $40 billion like Michael Bloomberg and you tie them up in litigation. That's what you do. You know, you can be somebody who espouses, you know, I don't know, the right values and tries to think about. But if you don't have the money to spend on it in America.
To back it up.
Yeah. Well, we live in a democracy. But the meaningful act of democratic participation is writing a check. That's how you actually affect the political process. Voting is, you know, at this point, we don't even know whether our vote counts. We don't know, you know, depending on what district you're living in and what gerrymandered area or what voter suppression or what interference from what foreign power, the vote itself, the franchise itself is ultimately meaningless. What is meaningful is how much money goes into the process and those people who are willing to put that money into the process. They are the people whose will is heard.
At the end of reading the play, I was thinking, it's such a bleak, bleak vision.
But it's what's happened to America. It's not a pessimistic vision. You know, it's hard for me to sort of recognize. I was at the Sun Valley this summer, and you know, Tom Friedman and Jim Fallows were there, Jim and Deb Fallows, talking about, you know, all the wonderful things that are happening around the country and the sort of renewal of innovation and singularly sort of ignoring the fact that we appear to be sliding further and further into a kind of, I don't know, some version, you know, of a third world banana republic. I mean, banana republic really is a misleading way of putting it, because I used to go home to Pakistan and visit my folks and my, you know, and the sort of rampant corruption and the rampant dysfunctions. I mean, that's very familiar to me now from American life today. But it's not the image that we have of our own nation. We are, again, constantly singing our own praises without taking a look at the stuff that we need to be taking a look at. You know, tearing apart the political fabric to, you know, enrich a very few people is not ultimately a long-term solution to anything. I mean, Henry Ford, love him or hate him, and there's lots of reasons to hate him. But Henry Ford said it very well, and he was no friend of the working man, trust me. He said, if you can't pay your workers enough to buy the cars that they make, you have a long-term structural problem. That's just a fact. It's not a right fact. It's not a left fact. It's not red flag or blue flag fact. That is just a fact of the economic cycle. And we're living in a country that increasingly wants to deny that. So I think that we are sowing the seeds for long-term decline that we will never be able to recover from. So I think, again, bleak, but I think realistic. That's unfortunately, when I say in Germany they go to the theater to figure out what they think about something. You know, if you're coming to the play and you're expecting something that's going to uplift you, just be prepared.
I mean, not even uplift you, but it's certainly, if you're paying attention, it makes you think. And I go back to the role of theater in all of this, and you mentioned the Greeks and Shakespeare and the idea of being the voice out there on stage saying, hey, here's the mirror.
Yeah.
Take a look.
Right.
Do you think people are going to hear your message?
I think that I've been fortunate with this play that I've had some fierce and strong advocates. Bill Moyers came and saw it twice and was a very, very vocal supporter of the play. And sort of, you know, I think that a play like this, complicated and difficult as it is, requires commentators to help the audience sift through the pieces and make larger sense of the picture that's being depicted. And so I hope that's what will ensue here. I think we're living in a time where the, again, useless moral triumph of identity politics appears to be reigning supreme amongst the arts. And I think that, again, it is something that goes back to the problem that we have with economic metrics being our only way of making sense of the collective good. And so you have a generation of artists who, because the audience appears increasingly not to understand the purpose of art and is being told that the purpose of art is either A, to make them see differently than they do and to not see the stereotypes that they do, and or B, to have empathy. And so in that landscape, you know, it sort of stands to reason that, you know, identity politics have come to the fore. And I think it's a back and forth sort of loop where you have this notion of representation being the central aesthetic experience now for most audiences, well beyond vulnerability or jeopardy or any of those things. People are concerned with how folks are being represented. That's what the work is about. But work like that, unfortunately, does not reflect or cannot reflect the deeper crises that we're going through, which are not about identity. They're about economics.
Which is why you keep focusing on them.
I try.
And you find fascinating and really strong ways to tell the stories.
Well, that's my job, is to entertain audiences at the same time. You know, I can't just hit them over the head. I can hit them over the head as long as I'm giving them treats every 2 minutes. So
here, have a treat. Why do we need art?
I think that art. It's interesting. We see increasingly the sort of gutting of arts education, the sort of, you know, disappearance of music education. And one of the examples I use is sort of to not understand that attunement to rhythm, that the ability to embody cadence at a young age is part of our response to reality, and that it's part of training our organisms to be available to others, to the world, right? Everything is not about square roots and frog dissection. Actually, those things are much less important to our ultimate being as citizens, as social beings, as individuals, as lovers, as parents, as teachers. Those things are so much less important than the ability to harmonize, than the ability to find oneness with other, which is something that choir and song begins to teach us physically, rhythmically. So our inability to understand something like that, for me to say that, most people these days would say, well, well-meaning, very soft, you know, soft sort of stuff. You know, it all costs money. It all got to come from somewhere. You know, the reality is there's never been more wealth than there is now in the history of the world, right? And nobody has any of it. Why? And that's part of the story that I'm trying to tell. Where is all this money going? Because it's going somewhere. And we are increasingly beholden to an ideology that is trying to just serve those ever-growing mountains of cash that are never being returned to the system. And we bring those ideologies into our schools or into our families or into our university systems, and we say, this is the truth. Well, it's not the truth. It's ideology. It's an ideology that is trying to support a system. And that system is ultimately not in anyone's interest. It's not even in the Koch brothers' interest, ultimately. Because if they win, they're the only ones who have anything. I don't know that that's much fun.
Well, because we are social creatures.
Exactly.
You're in the King Midas situation.
That's right.
That's where you are. Everything you touch turns to gold, but you're completely alone.
And it's this shift to the economic model that has increasingly made it impossible for so many of us to see the human values that gird our lives, right? And certainly as Americans, that gird, you know, there's a wonderful book by Christopher Lash called The True and Only Heaven, which is really an alternative history of what the progressive movement in this country could have been or what our country's history could have been had we paid attention to other values. You know, again, like I said, I'm not a bleeding heart liberal. In many ways, I think that liberals don't understand money. They don't understand that money has its own perspective, that property has its own interest, and that property's interest is going to be felt one way or another. And you have to understand that if you want to understand how to put together a society. But by the same token—
Or how to change one.
Or how to change one. Exactly. Or how to change one. But to not understand that property is not the only interest is to pave the way for a real estate magnate who does not say what he means, who is not what he appears to be, whose entire career is predicated on debt, is predicated on the gap between perceived value and real value, and who is the expression of our seemingly limitless passion for unreality. We are a nation which has become completely beholden to the unreal.
How do we change it?
Well, that's a topic for a separate conversation.
Another play. It's another play. What do you think the reaction here is going to be compared to, say, the reaction in Hamburg or the reaction in New York to the play?
I think that it's a community that understands that the loss of manufacturing in this community has been a significant chapter in our history and that the costs have been legion and painful. And I think that there is a suspicion. Sure, there's a rural suspicion of the city out in parts of the state, right, across the country.
Much of the state,
right.
Yeah.
But there's also a suspicion in this city of the coastal cities, you know, and I think understandably so, is it for the reason that I outlined earlier, where, you know, consolidation, scale, conglomerates, non-local conglomerates, banks, insurers, railroads, grocers, retail. I mean, you just go down. We're going to potentially lose our only paper in this city. And we're going to be one of many cities across this country, across the heartland of this country, that do not have a local paper to minister to the needs of our community. We're going to be getting our clatter of daily distractions from these, non-locally owned distributors of information who are benefiting off of the way that we consume stories that have nothing to do with our communities, right? So this is sort of non-local is the local is under attack everywhere. And, you know, I think that this play in a way tries to make a case for what happens, what the human cost of doing away with locality is. And I think that this community will be sensitive to that. Beyond that, I don't know. I don't know how people are going to respond. So
yeah, it's going to be interesting. And you talk about, you know, possibly losing the paper, which is something, you know, we in this building, you know, look at with great fear because there are things that the newspaper does that we can't do.
Yeah.
And we try on this show to fill that local voice and to have that local perspective as best we can. We're an hour a day.
Right. Well, we live in a society that is increasingly beholden to market pressures that really are no different in their capacity to censor our cognitive thoughts, the connections that we can make about our experience and about our country's experience or our community's experience. I mean, the market is just as good a censor as the Politburo ever was. And so we're going to be, and we are, we're dealing with that now. We're dealing with a kind of rampant groupthink and a kind of decline in people's ability to think critically, and the increasing rise of sort of advocacy, promotion, advertising, and public relations as a way of processing the news or reality itself. It doesn't bode well, you know. It's not just Facebook's problem. It's not just, you know, Putin's minions in Eastern Europe who are disseminating this kind of stuff. It's the nature of the very system that we're building.
I was going to say, we created it.
Yes.
Because it's something we wanted.
That's right. And we still do. We spend most of our day scrolling around on these devices that have monetized the act of consciousness. They have turned the thought process itself into something that is generating revenue for the distributors. So we're living as kind of indentured servants to this. Again, the idea that occurs to me is corporate totalitarianism. It's a version of a neo-feudal totalitarian corporate order. That's what we're living in. And I'm saying this as somebody who is telling you I am not a closet Marxist and I'm not a bleeding heart liberal. But if we don't deal with it, right and left, we're all going to have problems. And I think we're already dealing with that.
And I'm not sure that we're dealing very well with it.
Yeah, we're already suffering from that and not dealing with it.
Yes. Well, Iyad Akhtar, it is always such a pleasure to talk with you. We have such great conversations. Let's not leave it for another 2 years.
Yes.
Let's do it again soon. But best of luck with this version of the play. I cannot wait to see it. Best of luck with everything.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright and Brookfield native Iyad Akhtar is the author of Junk, which runs through mid-February at the Milwaukee Rep. You can find more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take another break and then return with the latest in our Radio Chipstone series. Lake Effect Weekend returns in a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
We're back with more of Lake Effect Weekend now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. At first glance, Gillian Laub's Southern Rights exhibit at the Chazen Museum in Madison could be seen as portraying the pageantry of a prom night in a small Southern community. But that's just the surface. Look a little bit longer and it becomes clear the photographs tell a much more complicated story.
Laub is a UW-Madison graduate, an author, journalist, filmmaker, and photographer. Southern Rights puts all of her skills on display. What started as a magazine assignment covering a high school prom in Mount Vernon, Georgia in 2002 turned into photographing the surrounding Montgomery County. Her closer look into that prom night revealed that segregation was alive and well in the community.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Laub tells contributor Jennifer Fields that while the photographs tell a troubling story, it's worth the hard work to get to the other side and see the big picture.
The text is so important to these pictures, and for me, it's not just the pictures. The voices and what the people in the pictures have to say is of equal weight, and this exhibit requires work from the viewer. It's layered and nuanced, and I'm asking the viewer to really take time and to not just make quick judgments. I'm really asking you to go deep and to read and to look and to think. And it's here to take you on a journey.
I really wondered, Gillian, if part of that is not only your desire, but when it comes to museums, we're not used to seeing photography treated as the way fine art is treated. And there's almost a natural wanting to spend that 2 seconds with it and move on. It's a photograph. I have a million of them in my phone. So when I walked in and I noticed that, I was almost more drawn to the text than I was the photograph. Because for me, it's a different way of being in a gallery and a different way of looking at things.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because, you know, some of these pictures, the posed pictures, some teenagers could come in and say, oh, that looks like a picture that I post on Instagram. But it's not. And there is a difference. And I do think of photography and a whole project as being an art piece. And it's this work is at best shown in the museum for me. So I've had a book and a film, and I have this exhibition. And the truth is, what gave me so much pleasure, each medium has, you know, its own beauty, right? So there are certain things that the film can do and express that a still photograph can't. But when I look through and walk through this exhibition for myself, it's like, wow, this is how I envision the work to be engaged. This is the way I want this work to be engaged with. And the objects, the ephemera, and the case, everything has a real big piece and importance in the story. So it's not just a single picture, it's the story together and the whole that is what I'm really looking to make an impact.
And what I'm interested in Jillian, is that in order to get these are intimate moments. You are not from this community. Talk to me about bridging that gap. How do you get so intimate so fast?
I think intimacy, for me, is the most important. The work that's not my own, when I'm inspired by work that has resonated with me and kind of is seeped into my brain, those images, you know, it's subjective, it's personal. For me, intimacy is what really resonates for me and what I want and what I'm attracted to, really getting to know the depth. And it does take time. Sometimes it happens automatically and there's like that magical, intimate, you know, quick moment of intimacy. And then sometimes it can take a long, long while. I mean, this project spans 12 years. So a lot of these people I've photographed over and over, and some of the pictures that I think are the strongest are, you know, the third time I photograph them, and some are the very first time I photograph them. So it's hard. There's no real strict rule to intimacy.
And then part of thinking about intimacy is that when you said earlier about students walking here or young people walking in here and saying, oh, I took that pose last week, or that's part of my Instagram, that's this sort of curated intimacy. It's a curation of life. This also is that in my mind, but from a different perspective. Because the young woman in the Confederate shirt leaning against the old car, in her setting, she is showing you her best self. Mm-hmm. I recoil from that. So mm-hmm. It's this idea of allowing people to see what you've seen through your sort of gaze, but also with their permission and not their participation and their desire to show their best. And it's like I'm seeing this world from two different perspectives, much like the film, which, to be quite honest, it took me 3 times to actually watch it. Someone says something where you have to, you're not going to solve the problem by cutting the branches off a tree. You got to nip it at the root. The minute he said that, I automatically had an idea of who that was, and I didn't want to hear it. This is going to be painful. I don't want to hear it. I know you are. I've heard this 1,000 times before. Mm-hmm. And walking into this exhibit, mm-hmm. when I walk in, seeing, even though you see a beautiful African-American couple, you see a biracial couple, and then you see this young woman in the Confederate shirt, it was almost like this was glaze. Like my eye went directly there, and I had to stop and be like, okay, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. Restart. Mm-hmm. Because you're seeing it through a particular lens. You've already made a decision. Mm-hmm. And you've got to now let this work speak.
Yeah. This picture of Shelby on her grandmother's car, she is presenting her best self. She is posing. She is proud. There's pride there. And what's so fascinating about this is that, you know, whatever I feel about this, which I don't agree, I think it is an offensive, racist symbol. And I wouldn't hide that if she asked me that. I wouldn't hide that. I'm very honest and transparent. I'm not trying to, like, have an I gotcha moment. This work, for me, working is a way to engage with the world and have conversations. So the camera in my life has acted as this way to ask questions and to have conversations. So, okay. Let's look at Shelby. Now, her voice, so that's where we come in here, because the caption, and also these captions are pull quotes from extensive interviews. So, but I think that the pull quotes, it's very hard to edit them, but the pull quotes are really to kind of get the essence of, you know, the importance of what the person was saying in a condensed few sentences. But I think it's really, really important that her voice is heard and she's able to share what she feels. And we need to listen to that. You know, we need to understand all different points of view, whether we, and it needs to be okay to not agree with each other. That needs to be okay. This may make a lot of people uncomfortable, but you can't shut your eyes and just close down on things that make you uncomfortable.
Because that's where you grow.
Yeah, and I do think that we are all complicated. You know, I also look at how was she raised, the context, what were her parents like? How was she taught? There's a much larger picture. So you have more empathy for her because, look, she had no other choice to think the way she thinks because that's how she was raised. So if you want to understand systemic racism or, you know, cultural phenomena, you have to look at the larger context and be open to that.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
This week, Fields spoke with author, journalist, filmmaker, and photographer Jillian Laub. Laub's current exhibit, Southern Rights, is on display now at the Chazen Museum in Madison.
We have time for a song on today's show from our latest Lake Effect on-site event in East Tosa. We were fortunate enough to have the Cock Marshall Trio as our house band for the evening, and they played this tune called The Funky Klaus.
Thank you.
The Cock Marshall Trio playing their original tune, The Funky Klaus. It was recorded by studio engineer Jason Reavy at the Lake Effect on-site event in East Tosa this past week. Greg Cock is the guitarist, with Toby Lee Marshall on the Hammond organ and Dylan Cock on drums.
We'll take one last break and then return with our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal stories.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And welcome back to another edition of Ex Fabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Rachel Owens, joined again by Ex Fabula co-founder Leah Delaney. Welcome back.
Well, hello. Happy International Friendship Week and Valentine's Day and Anti-Valentine's Day and all that jazz.
Happy Valentine's Day and Friendship Week and all that good stuff. And I'm noticing that there's something very bright and shiny on your hand all of a sudden.
Oh, that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What, you know, what is that?
Well, Stevie put a ring on it. I got engaged a few weeks ago. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I was the consummate bachelorette here in the city, and I was just ready to hang my hat up on that. And then lo and behold, somebody swept me up and held me captive and kidnapped me. Yeah, it's crazy for sure.
It came as quite a surprise too.
I had no idea. Absolutely no idea. And I'm still sort of wide-eyed and mesmerized by this whole thing because, you know, I'm quite independent and I have to learn how to share. What is this all about?
That can be tough.
Yeah, I kid. No, I'm over the moon about the whole situation. So yes, I'm definitely celebrating love.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thanks. Yeah, well, talk about a segue, huh? So this week's stories do involve love, friendship, all that good stuff. You know, we need to spread that love like a good disease in this city, as I say. So let's start out our show with our first storyteller. This theme was crush, coincidentally, and the storyteller is Sandy Brusen. Let's listen to her story.
Hello. Well, I was very happy to hear there was somebody in this group that was married longer than I have been married. I've been married 50 years last July. And I have to tell you that when I first met my husband, I didn't even like him. We met when we were freshmen in college, and we were having a lively discussion in our English class, and all of a sudden, this young man sitting behind me engages the teacher and finds out in the course of discussion that the teacher had a young child at home. And he said to her, well, who's taking care of her? And she said, well, she's home with a babysitter. And he said, well, you should be home taking care of your baby and not here in class. Whoa. Right? Now, you have to realize this was a long time ago. This was 1964, right? And the women's movement hadn't yet gotten started, but it was getting started with me. And I turned around, and I gave him a look, and I couldn't believe what had come out of his mouth. And I saw that he was sort of grinning and giggling, and as the discussion continued, I realized that he had intentionally dropped that one just to derail the class. And of course, then, instead of talking about whatever dry essay it was that we were supposed to be talking about, that became the subject of the day, and that's what everyone was talking about. It was an exciting class, but, you know, I didn't think too much of him, really, until a few weeks passed, and I noticed as he would come into class every day, I really noticed how nice he smelled. He had the most delicious aftershave lotion or something. I don't know. He doesn't wear it anymore. And he doesn't really smell that great anymore. But he really smelled great back then. And, you know, the weeks passed, and I started looking at him more and more, you know, and enjoying the way he smelled and the way he talked. And then, inevitably, I started telling my friend who lived two doors away from me about this young man who was in my class, who he had such a wicked sense of humor and how he would engage the teacher and derail the class and how good he really smelled. And finally, he asked me out. And I told my friend, you know, who lived two doors away, to be looking out the window and to be checking him out when he came to pick me up. And sure enough, you know, the day comes, he picks me up, get in the car, and we were, at that time, you know, I grew up in Chicago, so we were in Chicago and we were supposedly going to the north side to a bowling alley. That's what people in 1964 did on first dates. We were going to this bowling alley, but we're driving and driving and driving, and I realized at one point that we were going to Indiana. And I, you know, I didn't want to embarrass him by telling him we were going in the wrong direction, but finally he saw we had to pay the toll, and he wasn't about to pay the toll, so we turned around. But, you know, we got back home. I don't think we ever even got to that bowling alley, to tell you the truth. So much for the first date. But the next morning, I couldn't wait to call my friend up, and I asked her, okay, did you see him? And she said to me, well, I saw him, but he didn't look anything like you said. See, I had told her that he just like Paul Newman, and she said, he didn't look anything like Paul Newman. I still married him.
And that was Sandy Brewson with her I love crush story. I got a hats off to her for keeping her mouth shut during that car ride. Wow.
Yeah, I've made that drive many times on purpose to get to Indiana, and it seems like he'd have to go quite a ways out of the way to actually cross the line. So.
Wait a second. You actually go to Indiana on purpose?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah, great theme this week. Yeah. We're celebrating love and friendship, or perhaps anti-Valentine's Day, as some people like to celebrate. So we have another story coming up.
Yes, we do. And then we will talk about our upcoming events. So let's listen to storyteller number two, Ms. Barbara Lee. She told this story originally at our Karma Story Slam in March of 2018. Here is Barbara.
Karma is an incredibly wondrous thing. Very mysterious. 20 years with my partner, Robert, was truly cosmic. I mean, we were so different, and yet we really fit together. And he was a great storyteller. And Robert had incredible karma. He escaped death at least 10 times, and sometimes in very spectacular fashion. But the last time, the 11th time, when they wanted to do one more procedure, and he was like, you know, my heart's failing, my kidney's failing, I'm in pain. No, I'm done. I'm going into hospice. And he died September 10th, very calmly, very peacefully, and pain-free. And then I was alone. And I was like, I don't know if I was in denial or what, but I realized that I hadn't really thought about how I was going to manage to stay in my apartment without him in terms of the rent. So I started trying to find a roommate. I put in notices at MSOE, MATC, UWM. It was October 1st. And I wasn't really sure how I was going to manage this. Well, I was going to go out, and I got a call from the management office. Barbara, are you still interested in a roommate? Oh, yes. Well, there may be somebody here who would also be interested. Why don't you come on down and meet her? Oh, yes. So I came down, and I met this very lovely, very young, 22 or 23-year-old, with her parents. And she explained she's from Slinger. She'd just gotten this great job in Milwaukee, and she was so excited because she was supposed to move into a townhouse that very day, and she'd already put in her deposit. But her roommate had called her the night before and said, oh, I'm so sorry, but I just realized I added up all the money that it would cost me, and I was realizing I just can't move in with you next week. Really? She was pretty hysterical. She didn't know what to do. I said, well, you can come on up and take a look at the apartment. So she and her parents came up. They looked at the bedroom. And I was like, yeah, this is bigger than the one in the townhouse. And then she said, and I said, well, you know, you could have it furnished or unfurnished, and you can keep the big screen TV. Oh, and I'd have my own bathroom? Well, yeah. And how much does it cost? Well, that's a little less than the townhouse. I really started to like this person. She was really practical. She was asking all the right questions. I said, well, what do you think? She said, well, I really have to think about it. I'll call you tomorrow and let you know. So she called me the next day, and she said, well, there are four things that I really need. I need to make sure that it's clean, it's neat, and it's safe. So I want us to make sure to lock the door. I want to make sure that we clean up after ourselves, that it's tidy. And I want to make sure that, you know, I can have some space in the kitchen for all my things. Like, I like this person. She's really practical. So, yeah. And then she said, well, I also want to bring my piano, because I play the piano. And I'm like, a piano? Wow, she plays the piano, and I love piano. I'm like, I think this could work. She's like, well, yeah. She took a moment. I think so, too. And she moved in 2 days later, and it has been fabulous. She likes my stories. She also helps me with my computer glitches, of course. I show her banana pancakes with fried bananas. It's really something else. And then, you know, she plays piano beautifully. Mozart, Chopin, all the good ones. And then we do kickboxing together. I tell you. I still miss Robert terribly. But I'm not lonely. My friends say it's Robert still looking after me. I don't know what it is, but I'm really thankful for the mysteries and wonderfulness of karma. Who knew?
And that was Barbara Lee's lovely story about friendship. I gotta tell you, at the risk of sounding cliche, friends do make the world go round, and I am so blessed. We're all so blessed to have these good friends like that, right?
Absolutely. And I love those kinds of unlikely relationships where, in this case, she befriends this young lady just out of necessity at first, but then they end up getting along great. That's fantastic.
It is fantastic. Yay! For everybody. We have a couple of really cool events coming up I'd like to mention briefly. Our next Story Slam is going to be at the Lakefront Brewery. Those events, even though it's like a larger venue, that actually sells out pretty quickly because probably beer is going to be there. And that theme is damaged goods. That should be a really interesting event. We've got a lot of good stories about that coming up. And that's going to be on February 20th. And then 2 days after that, on February 22nd, we have our next Secret Fabula. And I got to tell you, we've been talking about doing this type of event for a really long time. The theme is After Dark. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It's going to be a sexy fabula. So
nice.
That is a membership event because it's a secret fabula. So really, there's no time like the present to become a member with XFabula. Support community bonding. Let's do this through the art of real, true personal storytelling about potential sassy After Dark stuff. So... again, that's going to be on February 22nd at a new location in Milwaukee, which is called Freight 88, which is over on 838 South 1st Street. I'm telling you, I mean, we're like midway through our season, but keeping it hot, you know?
I like that the After Dark show comes after Valentine's Day weekend. So time for people to get some stories developed as well.
Yeah, really. That might be fresh off the block. Well, fantastic. Again, thank you so much for having us in our little love story and friendship stories today. And happy International Friendship Week to everybody out there in the listening audience.
And thanks for coming in. And once again, congratulations.
Hey, hey. Thanks so much.
See you next week.
Okie doke.
You make me live. Oh, you're the best friend that I ever had. I've been with you such a long time.
X Fabula is a regular feature here on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now for All Things Considered coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.